This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted, neutral, global forum for healthcare product development. DIA, driving insights to action. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of Global Forum magazine. Early access and real-world evidence and data generation are just two of the high-level challenges facing European healthcare and regulatory systems. DIA's Euromeeting 2017 in Glasgow, Scotland, will discuss these challenges and ways to approach them in various forums. These include the new Diamond Session titled Major European Regulatory Science Challenges, which will be co-chaired by Dr. Joseph Sharon, Senior Vice President and Head of Regulatory Affairs, Pharma and Consumer Health at Bayer in Switzerland. He's joining us today, and thank you very much for joining us, Joseph.
Thank you for the invitation to talk about this important topic and this important session.
In your opinion, how will real-world evidence and artificial intelligence improve regulatory decision-making in the European Union, and when?
Well, as you know, we are generating nowadays quite a few real-world data. Everybody has these very sophisticated tools on their arm and with the watches, which are registering quite some data, but also other tools which are being used in order to generate a wealth of data. This wealth of data needs to be transformed into evidence in order to talk about real-world evidence. Unfortunately, there is not yet a clear definition in terms of what real-world evidence exactly is. And there was an article recently in the New England Journal of Medicine which tried to bring more specificity around this particular question. And in that article, you can find that real-world evidence has been defined as a gathering of evidence in clinical care and home outside of research intensive or other real clinical trial settings. If you then look at the, from my perspective, in terms of real-world evidence, the combination, particularly in terms of randomized clinical trials, and also post-approval safety questions which are coming up. In that regard, we in fact already using real-world evidence in some instances. I have not seen an approval yet on real-world evidence, but I think that in the future this may happen. The use of artificial intelligence in terms of deep learning tools, but also automation and things like that, is a area which is in the making. And there are a number of companies which are involved in the generation of these kind of tools and trying to adapt them to the use in the pharmaceutical environment and the clinical environment. This will take some time in order to get these tools completely up and running, but many companies are already investing in this area, and many pharmaceutical companies as well. So I, from my perspective, in the near future, we will see a high flight of these tools in order to help us to further generate real-world evidence for the use of medical evidence questions.
To be specific, and perhaps looking at your crystal ball, Joseph, do you envision a time where artificial intelligence tools, maybe robots, will be able to capture a great deal of real-world evidence and actually make regulatory decisions or facilitate them greatly more so than today?
I don't think that we will probably get in the near future to that. What I can see happening is that we will be able to generate tools which will be able to give us information on questions which we have. We already have, for example, the Siri some other tools which are out there where you can ask questions, general questions, where you get a general answer. I think that these tools will probably in the near future, on a not too far distant future, be able also to make predictions in terms of where certain things are going and what kind of a direction. Of course, they will not be able to say that with 100% certainty, but with a certain scenario building where you can have certain scenarios which will be provided by these kind of tools. They could be then transformed through a particular robot in order to be able to communicate it to the person in question, but that is a more or less a tool as an intermediate, as a tool which in itself will generate these kind of data.
Real-world evidence is probably fairly noisy and, if you will, dirty. Could artificial intelligence maybe help clean up real-world evidence and be able to spot signals more efficiently than a human examination of real-world data might be able to do?
Well, the point is that there's a lot of talk about the quality of data coming out of these kind of real-world data gathering exercises. And we have seen from EPI studies, which were generally done within one database, that sometimes these data were not suited in order to answer the questions which were being asked to these databases, and then led to information which was not always helpful from a public health perspective, and sometimes then also reported in medical journals or in social media, which then created quite some stir in the community, which then had to be addressed by the health authorities with some additional reviews or additional studies. In the case of artificial intelligence, it is possible to combine several of these databases in order to generate the evidence. And I think that by the generation of and the use of many different databases, it is probably possible to weed out some of the quality imperfections as they may exist and come to a closer reality of the real world.
Moving to social media, which you just mentioned, recent technological advances include the omnipresence of digital communication and social media. So the question is, what has social media made better and what has it made worse, possibly, for regulatory science in the EU?
Well, I think that social media, in terms of a region, is not an adequate point anymore, because the point is that nowadays social media are global, like, for example, Facebook, like, for example, Twitter, and any of the other communication tools which exist. Newspapers are still more traditionally looking at a particular country, also because of the fact from a language perspective. Although if you look into different newspapers nowadays from France, from Germany, from the US, you will see that several articles are very similar and addressing some more global perspectives in a more harmonized way. If you look at the interaction of the pharmaceutical information which is being provided, what you see very often is that the news media are much more interested in something which is catchy, which is going to be read by the people. And therefore, information which is being published in scientific journals, in generally news, which is of importance, is going to be also communicated through these more traditional social media. And this can go very, very rapidly. This can be very good if it's good information. It can also be sometimes more worrisome from a public health perspective if information is being provided, which would incite patients maybe not to take the medication anymore, and this can be sometimes very dangerous.
We are in the age of transparency, specifically in Europe. How do social media and transparency work together or align, if they do?
I think that if you look at the EMA and the CHMP and all the different committees which are in the European regulatory network, transparency is one of their key objectives. And they make minutes available of their meetings. They make also the agendas available of their meetings. And they also now want to publish medical data and make them available on a database. So transparency is a very important topic. And I think if you look at the European regulatory network in general, I think that they are at the forefront of providing transparency in regulatory questions.
So social media help transparency become even more prevalent, if you will?
Social media in this regard only repeat what is being published by those instances, and I don't see that they bring more transparency to the table. I think that they will probably enhance the knowledge about this transparency.
Let's say with Europe, what lessons have already been learned by or from the EU's early access tools and programs? Are these programs working as intended from your perspective?
You are aiming at the adaptive pathways and the prime conditional marketing approvals. Well, if you look at the conditional marketing approval, I think that's one of the areas which we have the most experience with. If you look at the last year since it has been in effect, there was a report published over the 10-year of use of the conditional marketing approval. There have been 30 medicines approved since that in that period. None of the medicines which were approved by a conditional marketing approval were revoked or suspended. And we also saw that more than 90% of the completed specific obligations which were asked to be fulfilled, it took about 4 years to generate the additional data needed and to convert a conditional marketing approval into a full marketing approval.
So would you say this program at least is working as intended? It's fulfilling the expectations that it set out?
Yes, I think that is certainly an area which or the conditional marketing approval has certainly helped to bring new products, particularly the seriously debilitating and life-threatening, to products with serious debilitating and life-threatening conditions, to bring them to the market. There were about 24 of those products which are targeting those conditions, and also often medications which will then provide new therapeutic options. If you look at the other pathways, so the adaptive pathway and the prime schemes, we participated in one of the adaptive pathway with two of our products. And what we learned in the process was that it is very important to plan ahead and that you have a clear plan in terms of how you want to further develop the product. Sometimes this needs, or not sometimes, it always needs a lot of people involved in order to make sure that the planning is done in an adequate way. But also that means that there is a lot of thinking going on and a lot of time being spent in order to make that possible. And this then goes beyond the time that the product will be on the market. So there is a lot of post-approval activity thinking necessary early on within the development. And this is not always something which is easily done. And so this adaptive pathway idea has got some criticism also from the HTA organizations because of the fact that they were afraid that that it brings the product to the market too early without sufficient medical evidence, and hence they couldn't give the adequate value to the product in terms of reimbursement and pricing. If you then look at the prime scheme, I think that the prime scheme itself is a very promising scheme where the EMA is working with companies in order to develop new products and bringing them to the patients in need much more rapidly.
Since we're on the topic of major European regulatory challenges, I have to ask you this question. What are your thoughts about Brexit at this time?
Brexit, as you know, will be enacted if the UK Parliament, I believe there's one instance in the UK Parliament which still needs to give its okay to it. But if that happens, then Mrs. May wanted to trigger the Brexit Article 50 in March this year, so that's next month. Maybe when we are together at the DIA meeting, the Euro DIA meeting in Glasgow, we will know a little bit more in this regard because it's the end of March. If you then look at what has been written about Brexit and what has been said by some of the people who will be affected by this, in particular Dr. Razi, who is the head of the EMA agency, he has publicly indicated that he is rather concerned about the staff and how the staff, to keep the staff motivated, but also to keep the staff within the EMA. And of course, as an industry, we are very interested in order to keep a functioning EMA moving forward. There's also a lot of talk of that the EMA would move to another country, and we have seen and already publicly a number of countries and cities putting up their candidacy for receiving the EMA. Apparently, it's a very popular agency in order to get into a particular city. And also here, I think that the industry, again, is very interested in order to keep a functioning EMA moving forward. And so we hope that these kind of changes, which are maybe coming up, will not affect the bringing of to the patients of new medical products, but also the pharmacovigilance activities which are happening, and the overall activities which are being done by the EMA will be negatively impacted by this kind of situation.
What do you think the role of industry might be as Brexit comes to pass, and perhaps as EMA is moved to another country? How can industry help ensure that patient health is preserved, promoted, and protected?
Industry can offer its help to the EMA. I don't know in what kind of a situation we as an industry could support the EMA in order to make this happen. I think that will probably need a little bit more thought because normally the industry itself is always quite separated from the EMA in terms of from a collaborative perspective. So I think it's more a question of how can the local authorities help the EMA in order to make sure that the EMA is moving, or if they are moving, and in these difficult times that they are supported by the European regulatory network of the health authorities.
And finally, Joseph, what new insight or idea do you hope attendees will take away from the Diamond session that you will be co-chairing?
I think that the overall takeaway will be that collaboration is key. To address one of the major challenges in regulatory science, to foster early patient access, we need to involve all stakeholders. Built on the achievements which we have reached and adopt, and that the attendees will have a common understanding of the value of what real-world evidence is and how it can contribute to established processes. And also they will realize that we need to further develop concepts and methodology on how to gather meaningful real-world data in order to translate these data in real-world evidence and be of a complementary use in regulatory science. We also hope that the difference between the EU and the US in the use of real-world evidence will be better clarified. We also want to point out that quality of the data is a key aspect, which we shouldn't forget, and we talked about that earlier, how artificial intelligence could help in order to overcome some of the quality issues. And in generally, what I hope that also will be very clear is that how we can better use real-world evidence for new products to make sure that patients in need are getting these new therapies more rapidly.
You mentioned that stakeholders must collaborate. To be specific, which stakeholders do you have in mind specifically?
Well, I think that if you talk about the stakeholders, that is the patient, the physicians, the health authorities, and the industry.
What about the payers or the health technology assessment agencies?
And the health technology, sorry, I forgot those, but they are really an important factor in this regard as well.
Well, those are all the questions I had. Joseph, thank you very much for joining us today.
No, thanks. I'm very pleased that, to be able to give a little bit of a preview of what we are going to do in that important Diamond session.
Look forward to seeing you in Glasgow. To learn more about this topic, visit diaglobal.org. For Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.